So this morning I'll be giving a Dharma talk with James Cordova Sensei, and the third respondent for the Dharma dialogue will be Dharma holder Reverend Bob Waldinger. And I just have to make a quick call before I start. Actually, last night I read over the Vimalakirti Sutra, which is pretty long, so I've got to say I just skimmed it. But I found the relevant passage from which our koan in the Blue Cliff Record, number 84, was taken. I also found out from one of the translators of our koan, the first person to translate the Blue Cliff Record into English, R.D.M. Shaw, a story that I'd vaguely remembered but hadn't remembered that clearly, that he tells about Dogen, Ahe Dogen, our ancestor, on his last night in China, encountering the Blue Cliff Record for the first time and being so touched by it that he stayed up all night copying it and brought it with him back to Japan. But I live in the 21st century, so I just clicked on my iPhone and pressed copy and put it onto my notes. So I'm going to read to you from that right now. The Holy Scripture on the iPhone 6 Plus. So this is the relevant part of the Vimalakirti Sutra that the Koan 84 was taken from. And one of the cool things I saw about the Vimalakirti Sutra is it's way longer than just this little section I'm going to read to you. And all the way through it, there are many teachings on the Dharma gate of not two, the Dharma gate of non-duality, which is open to us bodhisattvas, wisdom beings, who are devoted to this path of seeing clearly the nature of reality, which is not easy to do and almost impossible to retain, which is why we have these practices. In these practices, we get to remind ourselves again and again about something that the intellect has a lot of trouble with because it's a multifaceted teaching about form and emptiness and the way that form and emptiness combine to create the awakened heart life of a bodhisattva. So all the way through the beginning of the Vimalakirti Sutra, Vimalakirti talks to all the disciples of the Buddha. It goes on and on and on, and he corrects them in their understanding. Because the function of the Vimalakirti Sutra, which was written many hundreds of years after the Buddha's life in India and then translated into Chinese and other languages, is to refute the idea that there is a stepwise path to awakening that has to do with purifying and removing things. So even way back in ancient times, a few hundred years after the Buddha lived, there was this shift that we now are the product of in our Zen practice, to see that this very moment is revealing everything we need. That the Dharma gate to the compost, the Dharma gate to the ski slope, all of it is revealing this difficult to understand but so reassuring to taste teaching. So after he refutes them all, he gets sick and the Buddha says, you all should go visit him. And everybody says, no way. This guy, he just told us we were all idiots. We're not going. So then the Buddha has to ask Manjushri, who, of course, is the Bodhisattva of wisdom, who was the teacher of the Buddha and all the Buddhas who preceded him, teaching about emptiness, the master of emptiness. And he agreed to go with all of his Bodhisattva buddies. And that's when they all crowded into this 10-by-10 room where the wealthy layman, Vimalakirti, had gone in his sickness. This little tiny room, and apparently there was not enough room for all the bodhisattvas, but Vimalakirti had magic powers. and he created many, many thrones, 32 for the bodhisattvas and 32,000 for all the people they brought with them in this little 10 by 10 room. And then every single one of the bodhisattvas talks about their version of non-duality, what they understand about it. And finally, we come to this moment in the sutra. When the bodhisattvas had given their explanations, they all addressed Manjushri. Manjushri, what is the bodhisattva's entrance into non-duality? I like to imagine that they all say it in unison. It's, I think, bad stage directions. But anyway, they all addressed Manjushri. Manjushri, what is the bodhisattva's entrance into non-duality? And Manjushri replied, "Good sirs, you have all spoken well. Nevertheless, all your explanations are themselves dualistic. To know no one teaching, to express nothing, to say nothing, to explain nothing, to announce nothing, to indicate nothing, and to designate nothing, that is the entrance into non-duality." So interestingly, it was Shui Do who collected the koan for the Blue Cliff Record and comments at the end of the koan, who added the line, "In my opinion," or "this is the way I understand it." And we have to recognize how much that penetrates our teaching in Boundless Way Zen and in so much of Zen as it's come to America. "This is what I know for myself." But he never says it in this sutra. He just praises everyone else's understanding, which I think made Shui Do take as a shorthand. "This is my view." And then the crown prince, Manjushri, that was the way they referred to him, said to Vimalakirti, "We have all given our own teachings, noble sir. Now may you elucidate the teaching of the entrance into the principle of non-duality." Thereupon, Vimalakirti kept his silence, saying nothing at all. Manjushri applauded Vimalakirti. "Excellent, excellent, noble sir. This is indeed the entrance into the non-duality of the bodhisattvas. Here there is no use for syllables, sounds, and ideas." I love this response of Manjushri, which isn't in our koan, appreciating that even his view, the teacher of the seven ancient Buddhas and Shakyamuni Buddha, could be influenced by the clarity of Vimalakirti, this sick being who was teaching through his life to all beings everywhere. And this little section ends by saying, "When these teachings had been declared, 5,000 bodhisattvas entered the door of the Dharma of non-duality and attained tolerance of the birthlessness of things." I hope that happens for all of us. Just a little tolerance, maybe, would be enough to start. But this teaching is has so many aspects to it. The teaching in the koan itself, the teaching from the sutra, and how it reflects our own understandings. Now, the teachers have been talking together about the use of these kinds of texts, not as something to learn about or memorize or get to know from the outside, but how they function as mirrors for what we have tasted and felt and smelled and touched in our own lives. What is true that we have discovered that then finds a reflection in these teachings from people who lived hundreds of years ago, in some cases thousands of years ago. This universality of the search, this universality of wanting to understand. I see that the world is a certain way, and then maybe I've tasted that the world is completely not like that. So how can I step into a world that takes these two things into account? And Vimalakirti was famous for teaching through entering. So he would teach by going to the brothels and being a customer who would help the prostitutes and the brothels. He would go to the taverns. He would go to the marketplace. He would go to all of the different places where people gathered and completely enter into whatever activity was happening there and then teach his dharma of non-duality. In the Vimalakirti Sutra, he actually says quite a lot. He's not just silent. And then here he is now at the end of his life, actually. He has decided that the place he needs to enter is the realm of people who are sick. The whole world is sick. Everyone has illness, old age, and death. So I will do that and teach through that. And there are references to him being emaciated and decrepit, lying on his bed in his little 10-by-10 room that magically fills with hundreds and thousands of thrones. And in that connecting, he shows us a way to solve our problem. So on the form level, when sickness comes, it's terrible. Sometimes it's just annoying, and then sometimes it's excruciating, and everything in between. And Steve talked so movingly about this last night in his own life. And I think that so many of us have tasted the quality of what it means to live inside this human body. There's a beautiful section in the Vimalakirti Sutra that I didn't copy onto my iPhone, where he talks about the fragility of the body and how this very fragility is the Dharma gate. It's just what we're looking for. And so he goes to teach this. I know for myself, when I get sick, I don't want to be sick. That's the normal way that we are. And on the form level, sickness should be something we should be able to fix. But as we get older and more sicknesses assail us, or maybe for some of us we've had sicknesses as young people, or we know people who've been sick, we know people who have died. On that level, there is only the meeting with our grief, the tenderness of the heart that meets this great suffering. And then when we begin to open into it, something starts to shift and change, and that's the opening into emptiness. That this is the only thing that's happening and has no inherent qualities. And this is where Manjushri is coming from in this text and in the koan. It's not this, it's not this, it's not this, it's not this. And of course there's a truth in this. There's a profound truth in the teachings about emptiness. But sometimes, because it's such a relief to be sick and realize that we're not sick, we can get stuck there and not honor the sickness that's arising. We can use it as a trick, this emptiness, to take us away from the world as it is, the world as it manifests. And so these are two places where we get stuck. We get stuck in the world of form, and we get stuck in the world of emptiness. And in order to bring these two worlds together, we have to see that everything that we see in our lives is true. We have to do what Manjushri said when he praised all the bodhisattvas' views of non-duality. Every one of you is right. It reminds me of that great old Yiddish story that comes from Eastern Europe about the rabbi who was a marriage counselor, somewhat like our James Sensei here. And his wife didn't understand why he was so successful at marriage counseling when she found him very frustrating to live with. So he said to her, "Why don't you hide in the other room the next time I do counseling with couples?" And she did, and they came in, and the husband started, and he just ranted and ranted and ranted about how difficult it was to live with his wife. And the rabbi said, "Oh, yes, you're right." And the woman, the wife, said, "Wait a minute. Let me tell my story." And then she ranted and ranted and ranted and ranted. And the rabbi said, "Yes, you're right too." After they left, his wife came in and said, "How could you tell them they're both right? What kind of a counselor are you? What kind of a holy person? This is crazy." And he said, "You're right too." This is Manjushri. You're all right. Every view is correct. How can we bring them all together and step into our lives, no matter what they might bring, without getting stuck? And even knowing that getting stuck is also the Dharma gate of non-duality. So to further explicate this matter, I turn to James.
I also find that I am taken by the fact that the context for this koan is Vimalakirti's illness, that he's just feeling pretty crummy, and maybe, you know, as Melissa was saying, for her, maybe just wanting to be left alone, and, you know, here come all these bodhisattvas and Manjushri, and he's, you know, not feeling particularly well, so he just asks them, what is a bodhisattva's entry into the Dharma gate of non-duality? And then as each of them prattles on and on, he takes a nap. So I think it's just a strategy to get some extra rest. And you know, illness, to be physically very sick, is, you know, one of the most fundamental sort of very robust experiences of vulnerability. Rarely are we more vulnerable than when we are completely laid low by illness. And so the context of this koan is also this great container of extraordinary vulnerability. As Melissa was saying, the image of Vimalakirti is made skinny and decrepit by this extraordinary illness. And of course, you know, entry into all the koans is this this great Me Too. And in this place, of course, we've all been there. I remember for many years, every year I would catch the flu, which was horrible. And there would always be this moment, completely laid out and achy and feeling terrible, maybe 3 or 4 days into having the flu, where I would very distinctly have the thought that people who are afraid of death have never been really sick. So, like, just please just kill me, because this is awful. And then I discovered the flu shot, so that pretty much took care of that. I don't get the flu anymore. But we've all been there, right? We've all been to this place, whether it was a bug or, you know, some other failure of the body, maybe an injury, where we have been laid low and made extraordinarily vulnerable. So what is the Dharma gate in that spot? Because this is our instinct. This is my instinct. The places where we turn away. The places where we gather all of our strategies for distraction, that great suffering of wishing it were otherwise. And in some ways, you know, this question that he asks over and over again, what is a bodhisattva's entry into the Dharma gate of non-duality? You know, as soon as we sort of bite into the hook of the question, right, what do we start doing? We start seeking. Which I think, you know, we do. I know I certainly do this myself, this sort of like, okay, well, let me look for it. Which, of course, implies that it's not here, it isn't this, it's something that must be sought and looked for and strived for and gained and earned in some way. And it's a misdirection. Like most Dharma teachers, Vimalakirti is screwing with us. Go look for the Dharma gate of non-duality. And then come back and tell me what you found. And here is, I think, where the teaching settles in some way, the seeking is it, right? The Dharma has no place to hide. The transcendent has no place to hide. That the Spirit has no place to hide. That God has no place to hide. It's us who turn away. And we turn away precisely in these places where we have been made vulnerable. The places where, through our interactions with the world, particularly the world of others, we have been told in no uncertain terms, that we aren't good enough, that we are rejectable, that we are bad and unworthy. And each of us carries these injuries, these wounds with us, these places of a tender vulnerability, and we keep them as hidden as we possibly can. We turn away. And, you know, what is it? What is it for you? Maybe you've been taught that being angry and expressing anger is unacceptable. And you will be rejected and shamed. And so you have to go through your life pretending that you don't get angry. Or maybe you learned that being brokenhearted and weeping, crying out in your distress and seeking comfort from others is what babies do. And you need to man up. And so when you are brokenhearted, you hide. Or turn it to anger. Maybe you've even been told that your way of being happy and joyful and light and free is shameful. And you should keep that shit under control. I have a friend who tells a story of when she was growing up, being told that she smiled too big. You smile too big, you show too much gum when you smile. And so she spent her whole life trying to smile smaller. What is the Dharma gate of non-duality? And the thing is that it takes effort to deny these parts of ourselves that have been made vulnerable. Like pushing a beach ball under the water, it takes real, honest, legitimate strength to hide, to turn away from the Dharma. And so we sit here on our cushions and exhaust ourselves, and the beach ball comes back up to meet us. And all we are asked to do is let. God has no place to hide. The Dharma has no place to hide. Do not turn away. You don't have to seek. You are being sought. What is the Dharma gate of non-duality? She's right here. Do not turn away. Thank you. So our practice of Dharma dialogue, make yourselves as comfortable as you can. And encourage yourself to come forth. So sure that we know what is going to be rejected, especially by us.
I really like what you said about this idea that maybe all the work I've been doing, all the muscle development I've been doing to push things away, now I can use. And I think that's absolutely right, that what you've done is you've been really persistent. You've really stuck with something hard. And now what this practice asks us to do with to stick with something even harder, which is to look at that vulnerable place, to let the beach ball up, and hopefully when we can, we let it up little bit at a time, slowly, but sometimes it just flies up like it's a sheep. but you could stay. I think that we all need to give ourselves a lot of credit for the endurance that we have in whether it's pushing away, staying with. We stick with things. You wouldn't be here if you didn't stick with things.
Came to mind, it's sort of a, we've been looking at this as Vimala Kirti and
a little louder.
Vimala Kirti and Manjushri and all these bodhisattvas, but perhaps we could also look at it as Vimala Kirti and all of those impulses within one human being, and he allows all of them, and when he does that, his little room gets bigger and bigger until it can include everything. And when I was speaking to you, James, I remember saying, well, pain makes you so, it narrows your world so much, it's just, how can you deal with something like that? And I remember you saying, well, you know, what the practice is, or the therapeutic practice is to allow yourself to see all of yourself so that the pain, you may not be able to get rid of it, but there's so much more there. And I thought, oh, yes, this is what I took away from what Steve was saying, of allowing all this, allowing other things in, allowing resentment and anger and wanting to change it, allowing it all in so that the little 10-foot square hut just becomes the more church size.
Beautiful.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
I like the idea that Vimala Kirti, he goes out and he helps everybody by spreading the Dharma. And then when he's dying, then all the bodhisattvas come back, in return almost, to present their Dharma. And then he has nothing to say. In a sense, it almost feels like because it's like it's been said. And that's a beautiful part of that story to me.
Yeah, I love combining what you just said, Mark, with what Carol said. You know, there is this quality that if we're practicing and can stay open to all these different dynamics, then when we're weak and vulnerable and we can't do that, it just happens anyway. Mm. You know, so we work and we work, and as James said, we actually have to make some effort. And then the effort has to kind of... interact flexibly with no effort, and we receive. The world is just offering itself all the time, you know, not in some kind of weird way where we think, you know, there's some being in the universe who's giving us things and deciding things for us, but everything is here. And as James said, the Dharma has no place to hide. So all the seeking isn't a mistake. It allows the receiving to happen.
Yeah, and it does strike me that it is particularly in this place of extraordinary vulnerability that all the bodhisattvas show up, right? That they all come to visit, right, with their teachings. And like Carol was saying, you know, we become enormous.
So I don't have a question. I just want to encourage you all to speak up as much as possible. The air conditioner over on this end is making it very hard to hear, and we're losing a lot of, I'll speak for myself, I'm losing a lot of your words.
Yeah, and you know, feel free to come up here if you want. The folks who've come up are having an easier time. So let's make that a practice from now on for the rest of Sesshin, because I think it's going to be hot for the next few days. So really, and if you can't hear, hold your hand up in the a little bit more, and we'll see. One of us will see it, and we'll start being louder. So we'll respond to the need. Thank you for mentioning.
We'll start being louder, and then we'll come back.
Yeah, that's right. And then you have to do this. Just keep going back and forth. Okay. But thank you for naming it. And really, feel free, at the beginning of every Dharma talk, you can come up, and there's all this space here. So let's do it, especially if you have trouble hearing, and that air conditioner is blocking what we're saying because it's so important.
I was thinking about what you've been saying about James, about, you know, the way we've been raised to kind of, I think for myself, not trusting my own experience. Because, well, you know, it's been said, people tell us that we're wrong, right? That we don't have it right. And still, I've been taking this into my practice. It's like, I don't quite get it. I don't understand, you know. And somehow I'm encouraged. And then the other hand, my habits sort of like keep sort of not trusting myself. And sometimes I am wrong, you know. I miss the boat and get caught in delusion. And to, I guess, be willing to be deluded. Right? I mean, and yep, not get it right.
It's not so different from what Jess was saying, really. You know, that we do get we are deluded. Anytime something coheres into a view, there's delusion in it. And so it's not about being right or wrong. We say trust yourself. There's sort of this pop psychology thing, you know, just trust yourself. But what you're pointing out is a subtlety in that, because we can't trust our delusional narratives. What we can trust is something's happening in the body, in the heart, mind, that's real in that moment. And we can trust it and then see how quickly the narrative-making apparatus that's our beautiful big brains have gets in the way of the actual experience. And it's really very similar to Kate's story about the ski slopes and the dead guy on the ski slopes, right? We take a little bit of evidence and we make a story up. And we do the same thing, not just for people outside of us or things outside of us, things that are happening internally. We go, oh, that feeling in my gut, yes, that comes from when, and then we're lost. And then the narrowing that Carol was talking about starts happening. So just to sort of keep seeing the delusion-making narrative apparatus and then stopping. This is what Zazen helps us with, stopping and turning back to what is actually here now. And then being wrong a lot of the time.
Yeah, and this is what, you know, I'm struck by that. Sometimes I am wrong. Right? And this is where it gets tricky for me because the view is arising, right? Like it is being like you, and then we take it personally, right? Like I thought this, or you know, I created this view, and if you really look at it, it just showed up, right? but you know, we take it personally, and so we're ashamed of it, and so then we can't sort of put it out there as like, well, this is what's coming up in this, you know, gray matter, and it's actually happening. And then, you know, to not take it so personally and to just be able to describe it. Well, this is what's happening in my head right now. And I find myself having the experience of really believing it. What do you guys think? Right? As opposed to, I'm thinking this and I'm wrong.
And I'd like to just underscore the what do you guys think? Mm-hmm. Sort of back to what Mark was saying, you know, Vimalakirti, he goes out and teaches people and talks to people, and then when he's sick, they come to him. And, you know, Ray, you're saying, what do I do? Because sometimes I'm wrong. Well, what we do is we have Sangha. Mm. And we absolutely need each other to keep pointing to what is and to keep reflecting back who we are and where we are with each other. So that, you know, I'm lost in the middle of a hell realm, and then Rebecca pours my tea.
Well, and the extraordinary vulnerability of that, right? Mm-hmm. To trust Sangha, to trust your Dharma siblings, to say, this is what's happening for me. Especially, you know, when the experience is, I'm afraid I'm wrong, or I'm pretty certain I'm right. Also very vulnerable making.
And, you know, it strikes me, ever since the first comment and all the comments, that the Vimalakirti Sutra is a version of one of our Balanced Zen Dharma dialogues. You know, it's a bunch of people saying, this is what I think, this is what I think, this is what I think. And the people who Vimalakirti argued with didn't show up for this Dharma dialogue, right? They just said, I've had enough. But the Bodhisattvas did show up, and they were met with a great kindness, really, on the part of Manjushri and Vimalakirti. Yes, 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 you're right too, you're right too. And let me tell you what I think. Yes, here it is. And then Vimalakirti, what a beautiful response at the end. Just nothing. But it's not the end. And, you know, we didn't read the part of the koan where Shwedo, the collector, says at the end, what did Vimalakirti say? That's actually a very, when you work with this koan, it's a very important part of the koan. And you can't just, you know, sit there and not talk. what was his meaning? What was going on in that moment? How can we enter this moment of enough? The whole thing's been said. What's going on for Vimalakirti? And then the very last line of Shwedo's comment is translated very differently from, I've seen four or five different translations of it. Fully exposed is the one we did the other day. The one we use is, I know all about that. What? This is Shwedo, the collector. I know all about that. Or, the critical examination is finished. Or, everything has been revealed. You know, what did Vimalakirti say? When you hear everything in one of these Dharma dialogues, what's the truth of your experience before you make up a story about it? Or even, you can't stop it, so maybe after you've made up the story of that, can you meet it? Can you meet this internal life that's so rich and wide?
What I love about that last, what did Vimalakirti say, is this drawing back into curiosity, the sort of like plucking the period off of the end, right? Which we're very prone to, like, boom, I just want it to feel like, ha, got it. And this invitation back into, what actually?
I know all about that.
Right? The other side of it. Yeah.
So let's come back into our sasen.